And the views and opinions expressed on A Gaza Corner are those of me, Dory Stein, and do not necessarily reflect the views of KALW, a public media. And this is going to be sort of an ambitious Gaza Corner. I've not really done something like this before, which is go into the history of the roots of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. I find that when I meet people, and so many people are so tuned in to what's going on because there's an ongoing genocide, but they really don't know the history. And when we talk about it, it really seems to be appreciated. And also, when I talk to people about this, a lot of times a word pops up, and that is, it's so complicated. It is just so complicated. And I kind of bristle when I hear that, because once you learn the history, the root causes of the conflict, I don't think it is complicated. It boils down to an indisputable truth. And that truth is that people seeking a homeland cannot displace the indigenous or the native people of that region. It's a recipe for conflict and instability for generations and generations on end. Indigenous peoples governed themselves freely for thousands of years, and that was prior to the arrival of European colonizers. And the European colonizers changed everything from the 15th century onwards. In the case of Israel, what is referred to by many people as the settler colonial project, I think that if I can provide a good history, you will see why it is a settler colonial project. And what makes the 76 years of Israel's settler colonialism unique is not only a different paradigm than other settler colonial movements, and one that has enjoyed exceptionalism from day one, as Tariq Dana wrote in his research report that's linked at the Gaza Corner section of the playlist, Exceptionalism of the Israeli Settler Colonial Project. And in his words, quote, its ideological roots in Zionism and a potent blend of mythological narratives, militaristic nationalism, and expansionist aspirations. That's the potent blend that makes this settler colonial project unlike any other. And unlike traditional colonial powers, Israel operates without a conventional metropole. It leverages strategic alliances with Western powers, particularly the United States, in order to sustain its colonial enterprise. And this past Wednesday was May 15th. May 15th is the date Palestinians commemorate the first Nakba, which translates from the Arabic to catastrophe. It's when the State of Israel was established. And it was established over a majority of the historic Palestinian homeland. And I say the first Nakba because Palestinians are experiencing a second Nakba right now. In January, the International Court of Justice described it as a quote-unquote plausible genocide, and many other academics, including the Holocaust and genocide scholar Roz Siegel, refer to it as a quote-unquote textbook case of genocide. And his analysis is linked at the Gaza Corner section of the playlist. A genocide that has been enabled with the full complicity of the United States. It arms and provides political cover for the Israeli government. And the political cover takes various forms, including UN vetoes. So yes, there was a first and now a second Nakba, but it's misleading because the truth is the Nakba has been continuous not only for 76 years, dating back to Israel's date of creation, but well before Israel was created in 1948, well before its creation. Jonathan Kutab wrote an excellent opinion piece. It's called First and Second Nakba, also linked. I'll quote from it. It says, Palestinians speak of the ongoing Nakba, whereby the destruction of their national existence, the prevention of their return, the suppression of their identity, and the expansion of Jewish settlements has been necessary for the success of the Zionist project to establish a Jewish state atop Palestinian lands, unquote. The roots of the Nakba grew out of the emergence of Zionism as a political ideology. This happened in the late 19th century in Eastern Europe. In 1896, the father of modern political Zionism, Theodor Herzl, he published a paper called Der Judenstaat, which means the Jewish state. And he described in this paper the ideological basis for political Zionism. He believed that the way out of anti-Semitism for Jews in Europe, especially in the Russian Empire and in Eastern Europe, was the creation of a Jewish state. And he was open about his strategy. Quote, "We shall try to spirit the penniless Arab population across the border by procuring employment for it in transit countries while denying it in our own country. Both the process of expropriation and the removal of the poor must be carried out discreetly and circumspectly." That's a quote from Theodor Herzl from the book Palestine and Israel, A Challenge to Justice by John Quigley. Some Zionists initially supported a Jewish state, but not in historic Palestine. Argentina was one of the possibilities. East Africa was also a possibility. For example, in 1903, British Colonial Secretary Joseph Chamberlain offered Theodor Herzl's Zionist group 5,000 square miles in what is today Kenya. But the idea that won out was building a state in Palestine based on the biblical concept that the Holy Land was promised to the Jews by God. Palestinian Jews lived in historic Palestine prior to the 1890s, and they coexisted with Palestinian Arabs. This community of Palestinian Jews, they were known as the Yishuv, Y-I-S-H-U-V. They were 3% of the total population. And unlike the Zionist Jews, who would soon be arriving in serious numbers in Palestine, the original Yishuv did not advocate for a Jewish state in Palestine. Starting in about 1882, thousands of Eastern European and Russian Jews began settling in Palestine. I went to Hebrew school from third grade through 10th grade. I was bar mitzvahed, I was confirmed, I went to a reformist congregation. It was in Great Neck, Long Island, Temple Emmanuel. And looking back on it, I recall being indoctrinated with information I never questioned. For example, the Zionist phrase that to this day still gets mileage, quote, "a land without a people for a people without land." This was never true. Nor another infamous line I learned in Hebrew school, quote, "Israel turned Palestine into the land of milk and honey." For Palestinian Arabs, their land was indeed milk and honey and olives and more. In a report by Ellen Lutz titled Indigenous Peoples and Violent Conflict, also linked at the Gaza Corner section, The whole title is Indigenous Peoples and Violent Conflict, Preconceptions, Appearances, and Realities. She identifies two root causes common to Indigenous peoples and violent conflict that distinguish them from other conflicts. First of all, Indigenous peoples have a unique relationship with their land, and certainly that's true for the Palestinians. And it can't be easily translated into Western values of ownership or legal title. For Indigenous peoples, land is not normally a commodity, and it needs to be preserved for future generations. And secondly, Indigenous peoples aspire to fully exercise their right to self-determination. And whereas my parents' generation, I would love to speak to my mom right now up in the heavens, but I believe my parents' conception of Zionism was not for Zionism to seize all of historic Palestine, but to coexist with Palestinians, but to have a homeland. But Zionism has morphed into the quest of land expansion into all of historic Palestine, and denying Palestinian self-determination by any means necessary, including what's going on right now, the depopulation of Gaza, which that's an end game, and certainly has been voiced by Itamar Ben-Gvir and Smotrich and other people in the Netanyahu government. Also in the West Bank, depopulation and disappearance of communities is happening. The other thing I recall from Hebrew school, and again, not questioning anything, was that the belief that the Jewish people were singularly chosen to enter into a covenant with God, that is, Jews are God's chosen people, which to say it now, it's like ridiculous. But between that and believing God promised all of Palestine to the Jews, this is a recipe for the messianic Israeli zealots who want to forcibly expel Palestinians from their indigenous homeland and to repopulate all of the West Bank and all of Gaza. It's important to recognize that Palestinian Arabs and Palestinian Jews have legitimate claims to Palestine. The Zionists launched a movement of Jewish return to its ancestral homeland. But this was after a national absence of 2,000 years. Whereas historic Palestine became predominantly Arab by the end of the 7th century, so it's been well over 1,200 years of Arab presence in historic Palestine. In a book called Arab and Jew in the Land of Canaan by Aline Beattie says, in terms of Jewish history, quote, the extended kingdoms of David and Solomon on which the Zionists based their territorial demands endured for only about 73 years. Even if we allow independence to the entire life of the ancient Jewish kingdoms from David's conquest of Canaan in 1000 BC to the wiping out of Judah in 586 BC, we arrive at only a 414-year Jewish rule, unquote. And despite the steady arrival in Palestine of Zionists after 1882, not until right after the establishment of Israel in May 1948 was there ever anything other than a huge Arab majority in Palestine. Moving into the end of World War I, the Ottomans were defeated and Palestine went to the British. On November 2, 2017, Britain's then Foreign Secretary Arthur Balfour wrote a 67-word letter. I'm not sure 67 words ever did more damage than these 67 words. It changed the course of history. It committed the British government to the, quote, establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people and to facilitating the achievement of this object. This is known as the Balfour Declaration. In essence, a European colonial power promised the Zionist movement a country where, at that time, indigenous Palestinian Arabs made up about 90 to 94% of the population. Balfour intentions were not what you I mean, I don't know what you think, but maybe it's not what you think. Balfour believed establishing a Jewish state in Palestine would rid Europe of the so-called Jewish problem and could care less. He never communicated with the Palestinians and could care less that it would be at the expense of the Palestinians. So Balfour concluded, in order for a Jewish state to materialize, the local population had to be displaced and replaced. And at the outset, the British accelerated Jewish immigration to Palestine. But even by 1931, for example, the Arab population was still almost six times the population of Jews, which at the time, the Jewish population in 1931 was a bit more than 174,000, which was about 17% of the population. And that's from Edward Said's publication, The Question of Palestine. And interestingly, the majority of the 17% were not Zionists. However, David Ben-Gurion, also known as the father of the nation and would become Israel's first prime minister, he was intent in driving out Palestinians and wrote, I mean, there are so many quotes that have been attributed to David Ben-Gurion, and many of them are also questioned as to whether he really said them or not. So I'll leave you two that are not questioned at all. In fact, there's an article, again, linked at the Gaza Corner section of all quotes from David Ben-Gurion. And in his diary, July 18th, 1948, he's quoted in the book Ben-Gurion, The Armed Prophet by Michael Ben-Zohar, quote, "We must do everything to ensure they," meaning the Palestinians, "never do return." I mean, they not only destroyed around 530 villages, but they made them completely uninhabitable, essentially erased them. So the Palestinians could not return, despite international law dictating that they can. It was becoming clear to Palestinian Arabs that the European Zionists were intent on dispossessing them from their land. And from the outset of the onset, of the British mandate, Palestinian resentment grew against the British, who were facilitating an influx of Jews and also smuggling Jewish settlers into Palestine. And it came to a head in 1935 when an unprecedented influx of 62,000 European Jews arrived in Palestine, fleeing, most of them fleeing the Nazis. And this produced the first example of a action of prolonged Palestinian anti-colonial mobilization. It's called the Great Revolt, and it lasted from 1936 to 1939. The Palestinians demanded that the British control the influx of European Jews, that the British ban the passing on and selling of land to Jewish settlers. They wanted the British mandate to end and they wanted to be able to be independent like other colonies across the British Empire. The revolt was brutally crushed by the British with the help of Zionist militias. The British collaborated with the settler community and formed the Jewish Settlement Police, which by 1939 had 21,000 Jewish members. The British also created a British-led counterinsurgency force of Jewish terrorists named the Special Night Squads, which alongside settlement police terrorized Palestinian villages. The British, by the end of 1939, during those 3 years, had destroyed at least 2,000 Palestinian homes. They're the ones that started collective punishment of destroying homes, which the Israelis picked up from the British. The British also put 9,000 Palestinians in concentration camps and deported 200 Palestinian nationalist leaders, and they used torture in these concentration camps. At least 10% of the Palestinian male population had been killed in those 3 years, or wounded, or exiled, or imprisoned by the end of the revolt. By 1939, now in the wake of World War II, the British believed that Jewish support was automatic, and they feared that the Arab world might turn against them. So they published a policy paper called the White Paper, which was issued by the British government under Neville Chamberlain in response to the Arab revolt. And this White Paper was very beneficial for the Palestinians. The paper called for the establishment of a Jewish national home, but in an independent Palestinian state within 10 years. It rejected the idea of the creation of a Jewish state and the idea of partitioning Palestine. It also put limits on Jewish immigration and ruled that further immigration was to be determined by the Arab majority. Restrictions were put on the rights of Jews to buy land from Arabs, and it promised that only with Palestinian support would Britain allow a Jewish state. Zionists were obviously extremely angry, and Zionist groups in Palestine immediately rejected it and began a campaign of attacks on British property and on Palestinian Arab civilians. In response to this white paper, the Zionist terrorist militia Irgun, at one time led by future Prime Minister Menachem Begin, began plans for a rebellion to evict the British and establish an independent Jewish state. According to Maher Sharif, and this is from his publication, The Roots of Zionist Terrorism, which is linked at the Gaza Corner section, Zionist gangs, which had begun to form at the beginning of the 1920s, began very actively to commit violent acts, especially in the 1930s and 40s. The terms Jewish terrorism and Zionist terrorism, they were both used prior to the creation of Israel to refer to terrorist acts committed by armed Zionist gangs which targeted the Arab inhabitants of Palestine as well as the British. And since the Great Palestine Revolt of 1936, and right until the establishment of the State of Israel, Zionist terrorism was used as a critical strategic military weapon to accelerate the kicking out of the British and the founding of an independent Jewish state. Massacres were committed against Palestinians to terrorize them, and this created panic in the Palestinian population to drive them out of historic Palestine, and most notably the Deir Yassin massacre. Also, assassinations were carried out against the British and others as well, and bombs were planted in markets and King David Hotel and other places. And heading these Zionist gangs were men who, in later years, as I say, became prime ministers of Israel. David Ben-Gurion, Yitzhak Shamir, I mentioned Menachem Begin. The terrorism paid off as the British mandate officially ended May 14, 1948, and the State of Israel was born. And after the creation of Israel, the terrorist militias continued. They were the pioneers of what became Israeli state policy of terror, as evidenced in the numerous massacres committed by the Israeli army following independence, and massacres continue to this very day, especially in Gaza. Although the Jewish population doubled in a 4 to 5 year period leading up to 1948, it was still only a third of the population of historic Palestine in 1948, just a third. The Jews owned less than 6% of the land. And out of 750,000 Palestinians forcibly expelled from historic Palestine, almost half of them had already been expelled prior to the creation of the State of Israel. The UN, the newly formed United Nations, inherited the British Mandate's mess. And under the UN partition plan, Israel, despite 33% of the population, was given 55% of the land, encompassing some of the best areas and the main cities with Palestinian Arab majorities and the important coastline from Haifa to Jaffa. So the Arab state would be deprived of key agricultural lands and seaports. This led the Palestinians to reject the plan. And shortly thereafter, war broke out between Palestinian Arabs and Arab armies and Zionist armed groups who, unlike the Palestinians, had gained extensive training and arms during World War II, fighting alongside Britain. The Arab armies largely limited their actions to the areas slated to remain in Arab hands, but they were no match for the better trained and armed Israelis. The Zionist paramilitary groups accelerated its ethnic cleansing in the form of large-scale attacks aimed at mass expulsion of Palestinians, and this culminated in what's called the Nakba, 1947 to 1949. And regarding the partition, David Ben-Gurion said, quote, "After the formation of a large army, in the wake of the establishment of the state, we will abolish partition and expand to the whole of Palestine." And that is happening to this very day. That quote from The Birth of Israel by Simcha Flapan. Until Israelis and Palestinians understand each other's pain, and it's really hard for that to happen, particularly with Israelis, because they don't see what's going on in Gaza. They don't know. That's from all I read. They really don't know what's going on in Gaza, many, many Israelis, the majority. And so it's hard for me to see how they'll coexist until they can empathize with each other. I'll leave you with a quote from Jonathan Kutab. "It is not possible for one side to achieve total victory or to expect to live in peace and security while the other side grieves over its ongoing Nakba and other catastrophes. Perhaps the real message of May 15th, the Nakba, is that it is time to seek new paradigms that include rather than exclude the other, as we seek a path forward towards coexistence, equality, and peace, instead of total victory," which is a word you hear often from Benjamin Netanyahu, the prime minister, "instead of total victory and the domination of others." The words of Jonathan Kutab. Gaza Corner is every Saturday night in the 11 o'clock hour. I thought it was important to go over the roots of this conflict, because the history is clear. This is not, in my mind, complicated.